The question does arise in the philosophy of history, or the study of history, historiography, whether at times there are particular historical actors who enter upon the stage and transform everything, and thus are the key to all that happened from that point on. You can say that possibly of Alexander the Great. You can say that possibly of Julius Caesar. Doesn't have to be a general. You might say it of Martin Luther, for example. And surely you have to say it more recently about Hitler. And going back a century and a half before Hitler, or a century and a quarter before Hitler, you have to say just that about Napoleon, I think. And we are tonight going to be looking at the revolutionary career and the military career of Napoleon, who became the Emperor Napoleon I. My two guests are both of them historians who know that period extremely well. In fact, one of my guests, an old friend, David Jordan, who is professor of French history at the University of Illinois here in Chicago, is currently working on a book about the career of Napoleon. My other guest, Brian Sandberg, is professor of history at Northern Illinois University and specializes in French military history. Brian, would it be fair to say that Napoleon as conqueror transformed Europe, and if he hadn't been there doing that sort of thing, if he had been, for example, knocked over in the Italian campaign or sometime early in his career, and either sent back to Corsica a wreck or indeed killed, that European history would have taken a very different turn?
Oh, I think absolutely so. One of the great questions is, how did Napoleon really transform Europe? And was this a brief transformation that just ended up killing lots of people and transforming temporarily governments in the middle of Europe? Or were there lasting transformations? Did Napoleon make the same sort of lasting impact that the French Revolution supposedly did?
Well, what comes instantly to mind as a sort of a necessary free association is Stanley Kowalski, who, in lecturing his wife in that famous Tennessee Williams play, The Streetcar Named Desire, says, we have here in Louisiana something called the Napoleonic Code. And he goes on to talk about the laws of inheritance as based upon the Napoleonic Code, which apparently was in operation. Maybe it still is, for all I know, in the state of Louisiana.
I suppose parts of it still are, yeah. But, I mean, that is one of the great accomplishments of Napoleon, Napoleon the lawgiver. He codifies finally the French laws, and those laws are still lived under by the French. It is the civil code particularly that matters. And it's a wonderful system. It's rational. It's brilliant. It's cohesive. It's coherent. And on the other hand, the core of it lies upon a sense of order in the state, and that sense of order for Napoleon is based on the family. He believed that the father ought to be the emperor in the household, essentially, and all kinds of social gains for children, for bastard children, for women during the French Revolution, those were wiped away by Napoleon.
Actually, that touches upon his biography, does it not? His father, who was a true strong paterfamilias back there in Corsica, dies rather young, or at least dies when Napoleon is only, is he 16 or 18 at the time of his father's death?
At the most,
he's 18.
Yeah.
And he then becomes the head of the family and takes that very seriously.
Well, in a way, the head of the family. He's the second son. And there's a famous letter from Romain Rolland to Freud asking him about Napoleon.
Yeah.
And Freud, of course, explains that the problem with Napoleon was he was the second son. And so he had to outdo the first son, Joseph, the older brother.
Who he made ultimately king of what?
First, he makes him king of Naples, yeah. And then he decides that he ought to be the king of Spain, and he moves him.
it's a fabulous story. This is a fabulous man. His early career is as a military student in various French academies. He's come up from Corsica. He's partly an outlander. By the age of 30, he is, in essence, one might almost say, the ruler of France, in that he is the member of the consulate, or of the council, or is it the directoire? What do you call it?
There is a directory.
That comes before him.
Yes, and that's what he overthrows in 1799. Yeah. And then he creates the councils, of which there are three councils.
There are three, but
he's the prime.
He's primus inter pares.
That's right.
Inter pares. Very much
yes.
A primus.
Yes, but his rise to that point is really improbable. I mean, he's really discovered at the siege of Toulon, and
yeah.
He's discovered by Robespierre's group, and that he then survives the overthrow of Robespierre. Mm-hmm. And that transition to the Directoire It's really fascinating.
You speak of the Siege of Toulon. Mm-hmm. The British have come in and are trying to squelch the revolution. And that city of Toulon is where they've established themselves. And Napoleon essentially vanquishes them. He's probably about 26 at that point, is he?
1793. He's born in 1769, so he's 31. What is he? He's 20 when the revolution begins, so he's 20, yeah. 24.
He's about 24, yeah. And they make him a general by virtue of
overnight.
That achievement.
Yes. Yeah. That was not uncommon in the revolution, but you're right to point out that he enters the revolution, he enters the stage of history as a Jacobin, as an extreme radical, yeah. As a Robespierreist. And then, in a way, he's very lucky to escape the fall of Robespierre. And then he has to remake himself as a Republican, as a much more conservative figure.
And he becomes the leading general for the Directoire, doesn't he?
Well,
he has a lot of their business.
It's a government. It's a Republican government. There are five directors. It falls into all kinds of difficulties, and it's essentially a shrinking republic. That is to say, the ruling elite is shrinking, and the electorate is shrinking. And if they hold open elections, it's doubtless that they'll throw the rascals out. And it becomes clear to a number of them that what they need in the way Abbé Sieyès puts it is, I need a sword. And it's not unlike, for example, you know, the German politicians on the right questing for someone like Hitler, the strong man who they'll use and dispense with.
So how do they use him? What do they do with Napoleon?
Well, it's interesting. One of the other survivors from the Robespierre period is Carnot, the great organizer of victory, as he was known. And he's one of the ones who selects a new job for Napoleon down in Italy, sends Napoleon to what is supposed to be a minor theater, because the main action is going to be in Germany. And Napoleon then does so well in that 1796 Italian campaign that he's able to capture the limelight and really to turn his personal success into a stage for further triumphs.
But the Italian campaign is a campaign not against the Italians so much as against the Austrians.
Exactly. It's a campaign in Italy. But his primary foes are the Austrians here.
And the Austrians have been pressing against the revolution from the moment that it occurred.
Yes.
Possibly partially because
Marie Antoinette and
the executed queen was an Austrian.
Right.
Although there's an irony, because Napoleon, his second marriage is to the niece of Marie Antoinette. And she sits down for her first game of whist in the Tuileries Palace. And there's Napoleon and Marie Louise. And sitting on this side and that side of the table are Fouché and Cambaceres, both of whom had voted for the death of Louis XVI and her aunt.
But the way you build empires to consolidate power is to marry the daughters of your enemy.
Right.
And thus bring nations together.
No, and this is an interesting point in which Napoleon is both very much a breaker of traditions. He's a modernizer in many ways, we can see him. But he also does certain things by the old rules. So that marriage can be seen as old Europe power politics right out of the early modern period.
Yeah. We are about to pause for some commercials, which we tend to do every so often. When we return, we have not yet heard the Marseillaise, but the text of the Marseillaise is extremely interesting and bears a good deal upon what we are discussing. And I will look to you for some clarification of that gnomic utterance that I have just uttered. We return directly to David Jordan and to Brian Sandberg and to the strains of the Marseillaise, in fact, right after these words. And there we have it, of this song, the Marseillaise, which was written by Rouget de Lisle and by a man named Gossec. He did the music.
Right.
And it emerges someplace during the revolutionary years. It's still the national anthem of France. Of it, Michelet, the great historian of the French Revolution, says that it is le plus sanguinaire des hymnes nationaux, the bloodiest of all national hymns,
yes,
or national anthems. What are the words in translation?
I don't want to translate the entire song, but it's a marching song. And it's a marching song of soldiers heading to combat the enemy. And so you have the red bloody banner of the enemies of tyranny.
L'étendard sanglant élevé. The bloody
exactly.
banner is raised, and the enemy are coming to égorger nos fils et nos compagnes. How do you
Yes, to cut the throats of our
cut
wives
the
and
throats.
Children. Yeah.
Yes.
And this is such a bloody song. That a few years ago when I was in France, there was actually a political movement afoot to change the words
yeah.
and make it much more green and happy and appealing, and that move was defeated.
The point of the song is we are engulfed by enemies who want to kill us, who want
yes.
to kill our revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I chose to play it now is that this was in a way the justification that Napoleon used for all the wars that he led France into.
Yes and no. I mean, he wasn't quite as paranoid about being surrounded by the enemy as was the revolution when the war begins in 1792 and that song first shows up in Paris. But he was certainly surrounded by enemies, and he certainly, when he reflected back on his life and during the course of his life, always spoke of the wars being forced upon him.
Yeah.
That he didn't go seeking those wars, but these unreformed, intransigent enemies made it necessary.
All right. That leads to a very basic question. Do you buy that?
Do I buy that? well, I mean, if you define the wars as they were defined by the French in 1792 as a kind of crusade, an ideological war in which the French were, the enemy was all of the crowned heads of Europe. In fact, the Jacobin Amar says, the revolution will not be over till the last priest, the last king is strangled in the entrails of the last priest. I mean, that kind of war.
Speaking of bloody rhetoric.
Yeah. And Napoleon very clearly takes that up, although he also has this imperial dimension that he adds to it, but it's a crusade. Yeah, to the degree to which he believes it as those who preached the war in 1792 believed it, that's a difficult question.
Yeah, on the one hand, Napoleon is really the inheritor of the French Revolution here. He inherits the wars. He also inherits the motivation for the wars. And ever since 1793, when you'd had the levée en masse, this mass conscription, France had essentially tried to mobilize the entire population, not just young men, but the entire population, to do the work of preserving liberty, preserving freedom for the French Revolutionary government. He inherits that. Now, the thing is that Napoleon doesn't know any limits, and when France is no longer threatened and the government doesn't have to be preserved, Napoleon keeps wanting to expand and to go on and on. So in that sense, he's not, I think, an inheritor of the French Revolution.
He's got essentially 15 years, essentially from 1800 through 1815, isn't that right?
Right.
In which he is ruling France and ravaging Europe, or certainly running around Europe with his vast Grande Armée, the Grand Army. How would one take a quick, we're not going to review all of the battles and all of the conquests, but what's the overview of what he and his Grand Army did during those 15 years?
Well, I mean, it's often thought of as the inner and the outer empire. The first things that he conquers are Italy, and then he proceeds to redraw the map and create kingdoms here and there, and then he conquers...
Planting his brothers,
and Murat, his general, and his stepson Eugène, and so on. He first tries to put relatives and trusted marshals on the thrones to run this immense empire that he's accumulated. And then he gets very disillusioned with them and wants everything in his own hands, and then starts trying to run the whole thing himself. Various parts of Germany, he destroys Prussia in 1806. He humiliates Austria. He has a great chunk of Poland, and he creates a touchy of Warsaw. He has Belgium, which has already been won. He, in 1808, decides he's going to gobble up Spain as well, and that begins his undoing. Spain is really just too much for him to swallow. He's never attempted to take a whole peninsula down, and it takes him down.
How does he build and maintain the loyalty of all those who are drawn into or volunteer their way into his Grande Armée. How, in fact, does he keep France loyal and to him and enthusiastic for him as he presides over the death of hundreds of thousands of their young men?
Well, the most important aspect of this is keeping the loyalty of the army. And I think he does that by essentially giving them honors and giving them glory. Now, that's one line of the Marseillaise that he does carry over from the French Revolution, that it's for glory, right? That they are actually fighting. And the soldiers buy that. They're given awards.
How does he give them honor and glory? A lot of medals.
Well, the Legion of Honor
is
created by Napoleon. Yeah. That is a public award that is granted.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have publicity in his newspapers. He really has a lot of propaganda machines there and can use these not only for his own glorification, but also to glorify other soldiers around him and let them share in that glory. And this motivates lots of the soldiers, especially officers or non-coms who want to become officers, to continue to follow him. And they do, I think, believe in Napoleon for a very long time.
And he establishes a court as regal as Versailles under Louis XIV.
Oh, yes, it's quite extraordinary after he makes himself emperor in 1804.
Yeah.
I would just to return to for a moment to this, one of the things that he does, and I think is very indicative, is the gorgeous uniforms that his army wears. And he has a hand in designing all of those uniforms.
Right.
And I think whenever you come upon a society where the army or the military is so gorgeously arrayed and stands out from anybody else, you are clearly signifying that they're among the most important people in society.
Got a buddy over at Notre Dame, Bob Schmuel, who did a book some years ago. He's an observer of American politics, but his book is titled Statecraft and Stagecraft. And in a way, Napoleon is the first great, or is he the first great master of modern stagecraft
in politics? He's the first one, I think, clearly to me. He's very modern in that sense. He's the first one to understand clearly that one can manipulate public opinion.
Yeah.
One of the first things he does in the Italian campaign, first he pays his soldiers. And he pays him in specie and not in that garbage paper money that's being devalued. And the second thing that he does, he buys two newspapers, one in Italian and one in French, most of which he writes himself. The Italian one's obviously addressed to the Italian nation, and there he poses as the liberator, and the other's addressed to the French, and there he poses as the man bringing glory to the French.
And he does know how to stage his own presence, too, and preserve that. I mean, he uses, for example, another great survivor of the Revolution, David, the great painter, and orchestrates his image very well with painters. And then, of course, this is reproduced with pamphlets, very important for the time, because not everyone gets to see the paintings.
So he is his own Dr. Goebbels, in a way.
Oh, yes. Hmm? Oh, yes. There's a famous anecdote where someone asks him, have you seen the article today in Le Moniteur, which is the semi-official newspaper?
Yeah.
He said, I wrote it.
Yes. But one question we haven't yet addressed is, what was the nature of his military accomplishment? Was he, in fact, a great military innovator and a military genius in the fighting of battles?
I think that you can see him as a military genius if you focus on operations and tactics. And if you also focus on that great period that he has, the great run between 1800, the Marengo campaign, and 1807. But if you look before that, there are already some questions. The Egyptian campaign didn't go so well. And if you look after that period, if you look at the Spanish expedition, that's a disaster. The Russian expedition is a disaster. And then the 1813, 1814 campaigns, you have a flash of brilliance every once in a while on this battlefield or that battlefield. But Napoleon is ultimately a failure in those campaigns, and again at Waterloo. So,
David, you are studying, among other things, in the book that you're now working on, his military tactics, or his military tactics and strategy. What was distinctively Napoleonic about the way he fought battles and wars?
He's not a great innovator in the sense that he imagines things that had never been imagined before. What he does is he sort of brilliantly takes up the reforms of the 18th century, particularly the use of artillery and massing it and moving it very fast. He is the master of movement, and all of the battles that Napoleon fights that are on his terms, where there can be movement, because he could maneuver an army on the field and he had this extraordinary capacity for improvisation, he wins. He's undefeatable in that form. All the battles that he fights that are slugfests, he loses. At Eylau in 1807, he doesn't lose, but it's incredible bloodying. But at Borodino, he does lose. And the Battle of the Nations at Leipzig, he does lose. And by the time he gets to Waterloo, he's got no cavalry. I mean, it's sort of like I like the analogy of Muhammad Ali. If Muhammad Ali could get people to fight his kind of fight, he wins, because he's graceful, he's fast, he's smart, and he's very powerful.
What was the...
But the slugfest with Frazier, where they just stood there and punched the bejesus out of each other for 15 rounds, and both ended up in the hospital, is a different
kind of
fight.
What was the Muhammad Ali slogan? Float like a butterfly,
sting like a bee.
You say that's what Napoleon did.
Well, whenever he could fight his kind of battle. Yeah.
This is the problem, though. When you talk about Napoleon the politician and Napoleon the grand strategist, he gets involved in conflicts that he can't win. He can win battles, perhaps, but he's not going to win the overall conflict because it's poorly conceived as an overall plan. And then he also doesn't know when to stop. Several times, the Austrians, the Russians, even the British offer Napoleon deals that will allow him to produce a peace that will perhaps be workable. And he refuses those opportunities.
Unthinkable for him, that's right.
Turns it down because he has to have more glory, and his ambitions are just unbounded.
At some point, at one point, much of European culture and of the purveyors of culture were fascinated by, and in some sense taken in by Napoleon. No one any less than, of all people, Ludwig von Beethoven. Mm-hmm. We're pausing for a quick update on the news. When we return, the symphony that Beethoven wrote for Napoleon but then changed his mind. We'll hear at least a few strains of the Eroica and then talk about that in relation to Napoleon. That is indeed Beethoven's Third Symphony, commonly known as the Eroica. The performance is by the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. I've just gone looking. I entered in Google Beethoven and Napoleon, and here's what I get in the first entry that I found. In a letter to his publishers in August 1804, Beethoven wrote, "This symphony is really entitled Bonaparte." There are many theories regarding the Eroica's dedication to Napoleon Bonaparte, and the extent to which the idea of the French post-revolutionary hero is reflected in the equally revolutionary music. Some sources claim Eroica was written at the suggestion of the French ambassador to Austria, General Bernadotte, with whom Beethoven had formed a friendship, but there's no conclusive proof of this or of other theories. Whatever the true genesis of the Eroica, according to Beethoven's pupil Ferdinand Ries, at the time he was writing the symphony, Beethoven, quote, held him, Bonaparte, in the highest regard and compared him to the greatest Roman consuls. There's no doubt that Beethoven identified with the ideals of the French Revolution, which Napoleon embodied, and that the conflict and huge social changes that the revolution brought about certainly called for new kinds of musical expression. So, why didn't... that's great, but apparently Beethoven changed his mind with regard to the dedication of the symphony. Why?
He did change his mind. I think a lot of people in Germany and elsewhere throughout Europe were very excited about the potentiality of Napoleon changing their societies. And when that didn't happen, or the change wasn't the expected type of change, instead it was war, people were upset. And Beethoven actually scratched out that dedication and changed it. One of the times I was in Paris recently, there was an exhibition in which they had the original score there with that dedication scratched out. Really beautiful to see.
Well, the date is important, too, 1804. That's when Napoleon crowns himself emperor. Mm-hmm. That's when some people think the mask has finally come off and the Republican was really a performance on Napoleon's part, and he is the emperor.
Also, he shows up in Vienna with cannons.
Well, that's later. That's 1809, and Beethoven happens to be there, and there's a wonderful scene. I mean, Haydn is dying in Vienna in 1809, the greatest composer probably of the classical period.
Yeah.
And he dies while the siege is going on. Beethoven is there and has his fingers stuck into his ears to preserve what little hearing that he has. And it's a wonderful image for me of the end of the Ancien Régime and the beginning of the new, and the brutality with which that transformation is taking place. That story is often told, the dedication is often told with regard to the Emperor Concerto, the fifth piano concerto of Beethoven's, which is written around 1809, in which the same thing happens. Goethe always had a bust of Napoleon in his study. Interesting, you wouldn't expect Goethe to think that way.
You both are old Parisian hands.
Mm-hmm.
You've been in France many times for your research and lived there for periods of time, I know. I've been there fairly often, and I suppose no particular location in all of Paris strikes an American as more complicated and more paradoxical than Les Invalides, the tomb, the monument to Napoleon. He's buried there. I've never seen a mausoleum more grandiose and grotesque than Les Invalides. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, when they finally decide, he dies in St. Helena in the middle of the South Atlantic, and he dies in 1821, and finally in 1840 they decide to bring the remains back, and there's a vast discussion of where is one going to put these? Can one build a tomb for him? Well, they finally fix upon Les Invalides, which has been built in 1670s by Louis XIV as an army hospital, and at the back of it is a small church, the Church of Saint-Louis, with a great Gabriel dome of it, and they fix on that, and he's buried in the center of that dome, and it is spectacular, you must admit, and that museum as well. You walk into the museum, and the whole top floor is devoted to Napoleon. Napoleon's bed, Napoleon's shoes, Napoleon's sword, Napoleon's toothbrush. I mean, it's quite incredible. It's just a worshipful place.
Is it the case that the French still treat him as a demigod?
Some people do. It depends on your politics.
Right.
This is, as with many French heroes, a political move, how you treat revolutionary and post-revolutionary.
Although Dominique Villepin wrote a recent book about Napoleon, which celebrates him.
The foreign minister of France.
That's right. It seems to be that if you want or if you regret the loss of French power, that you then write about Napoleon in a very optimistic way. And if you don't regret the passing of the French Empire and all of that kicking Europe around, then you write about Napoleon in a negative
way. De Gaulle used to speak of France's mission civilisatrice, the mission to civilize.
Right.
And I think the term comes from Napoleon.
Maybe, I don't know that, yes. I mean, it's one of the things that he said. But the reality on the ground was, of course, that if you became part of the Napoleonic Empire, that meant that the recruiting sergeant was at your door, and the taxes were very efficiently collected. And in fact, the promise of a liberator vanished.
But pride must have a fall, as we know. And hubris is the ultimate sin, the ultimate flaw, which leads to tragic consequence. And when we return after some impending commercials, we will talk not about the rise of Napoleon, but about the slow but decisive fall of Napoleon. Our guests tonight, as we are discussing the career of Napoleon Bonaparte, are Brian Sandberg, professor of history at Northern Illinois University, and David Jordan, professor of history at the University of Illinois Chicago, both of whom specialize in French history, and particularly in that period, though Brian Sandberg has also worked an earlier period, the religious wars in France a few centuries before. David Jordan has been fixated on the French Revolution and its major figures for many years. One of your major works of a few years ago, which we discussed on this program, is titled The Revolutionary Career of Maximilien Robespierre. And he was an interesting fellow, too.
Yes, yet another.
Yet another. And he came to an end as dreadful, more dreadful than Napoleon.
Yeah, I'm much more violent. I mean, Napoleon does die a natural death, if we exclude all the argument about him being poisoned, which I find very ambiguous. But I think those three figures about whom I've written really encompass, in a way, the French Revolution. I mean, the king, Robespierre, who represents the articulation of the Jacobin position in the revolution better than anyone else, and Napoleon, who I think is the great inadvertent saver and preserver of the French Revolution.
Or transformer.
Well, perhaps transforming.
Into something else.
The revolution is a very complicated inheritance, and his view of it, there are many things that can be directly traced back, and you don't have to be, you know, a Jacobin to be a revolutionary. Mm-hmm. There are many kinds of revolutionaries.
Let's look at the long story of the end, the long denouement. What's the beginning of the end?
I think Spain is the beginning of the end.
What happens in Spain?
Well, the very decision to invade Spain is a big mistake, because it's just not necessary to achieve what Napoleon is wanting to achieve.
Well, what's his motivation? What does he give as the reason?
He cannot be stopped with his desire for vengeance, I think. He wants to get at Britain above all, but he can't. So he gets at the allies and friends of Britain, and so he goes after Spain. Now, he topples the government very easily, removes them, but he can't occupy and hold down Spain. Why? Because you have British aid flowing in, but also you have a very important partisan movement. It's guerrilla warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the origin of the word, and it's a modern term, comes from. Guerrilla is from this Spanish conflict. And the French troops are bogged down there. Thousands and thousands of French troops are held there as late as the Russian campaign in 1812, because the region cannot be pacified. So Napoleon's intervention into Spain, I think, harms not only his later campaigns in Central Europe, it also hurts his campaign in Russia, and is the ulcer, as was referred to, the Spanish ulcer.
Is it as simple as this? He decides after a while, well, we can't really conquer Spain, let's go conquer Russia?
No, I'm not sure that's right. I would disagree with Brian about one thing. I don't think it is just his insatiable greed and desire for more and more property. It becomes irresistible. I mean, Spain really implodes, and they invite Napoleon in. The two factions, the old doddering king and his sons, and it's irresistible to Napoleon. And of course, he miscalculates horribly. He thinks he'll be able to take over Spain quickly, and he retains that misrepresentation of Spain for a very, very long time. He figures he spends about 6 weeks in Spain fighting himself. And the rest of the time, he figures, I just have to get back there and set things right. It's these squabbling generals that are not getting it right at all. But it is the guerrilla war, in a sense, that does him in, and it is just the size of Spain that does him in. And he gets involved. I mean, he sort of turns his back on Spain because he never takes it seriously, which is very peculiar. And it's not, I'm done with Spain and let's go to Russia. It's that I have to go to Russia.
Why? What draws him eastward?
What he says, and it's probably bogus, he says that the continental system, which is an attempt to blockade England out of trade with Europe, is leaking, and it's leaking in the Baltic Sea, and it's Russia who's allowing it to leak, and therefore he has to go and teach them
a lesson.
By the way,
a necessary intervention, a basic question that must be addressed. Ultimately, he's vanquished by Britain. Britain, to be sure, in an alliance with many other continental powers. What's the nature of the French-British hostility during those Napoleonic years? Why was Britain essentially the eternal enemy of Napoleon?
I don't know. I mean, it is an obsession. And it's an obsession to which there's no easy solution. One of his first appointments is in 1803, earlier than that, he's given the job of arranging for the invasion of England. And he says, give me 36 hours and a good wind and I will... And then he decides, well, this is a cockamamie scheme, and we can't cross the channel. And he never gives up on this. You know, the nation of shopkeepers, he's going to teach them a lesson. He hates them, he despises them, he loathes them. He thinks they're... but who can explain this kind of thing? There's no reason why Napoleon Bonaparte should have felt so deeply about England. He's never there.
But then the British animosity towards Napoleon is reactive to his... intention to destroy Britain.
Well, the British animosity towards Napoleon, he's just a continuation of the French Revolution for them.
I would agree with that. I think this stems from the French Revolution.
Uh-huh.
And up until 1805, you can see this a continuation of the French Revolution. But once you have the Battle of Trafalgar, and you know the French and Spanish combined navies are eliminated, essentially, as fighting forces,
right.
You know, Britain really has no threat naval coming from France, from Napoleon. But the attempts to work out any sort of a peace, I think, that Britain would accept, Napoleon refuses. He's not willing to compromise ever. So there's no possibility of peace there, because Britain cannot be forced without a navy
right.
to accept any peace. And this is a problem with Napoleon. He wants to dictate the terms of peaces. if he can get everything he wants, then he can have peace.
But if you have to
compromise, he's not willing to accept that.
Napoleon does not negotiate. He tells people what the settlement is. Georges Lefebvre, the great French historian, says that if Napoleon, the great mistake is, he simply should have left England alone. England was interested in her empire and the Sugar Islands. England would not have troubled France, let French hegemony dominate the continent. But he incited England, so to speak.
A small incidental chapter or footnote in all of this is his sale of Louisiana, which is much more than the present state of Louisiana, to America. A deal worked out with Thomas Jefferson. What year is that?
1803.
And what motivates Napoleon to sell Louisiana?
Money.
Yeah.
Money.
And disinterest.
It's relatively irrelevant. I mean, Napoleonic imperial ambitions are focused on Europe.
Sure.
I mean, there are certain adventures. The Egyptian campaign, which was not all his doing, that was also the directorate.
Well, and the Haitian invasion.
The Haitian invasion.
It goes sour.
Yeah.
But doesn't care about the New World.
No.
That's after Toussaint Louverture has
and in fact, he
kicked the French out of Haiti.
That's right. Originally, and then Napoleon goes in and sends his brother-in-law who dies of yellow fever. And he captures Toussaint, brings him back to France, and treats him with the utmost cruelty. And in fact, it's a form of torture, you know. And he dies in French hair. And Napoleon, one should not forget, reinstitutes slavery in the New World, in Haiti. It was gone with the French Revolution. It's back.
My goodness. I didn't know that.
Yes, because he wants to base, as he does every place he goes, he bases his rule on the local elites.
We are due for some commercials. We come to the Russian campaign, which devastated the Grand Army and is truly the beginning of the end for Napoleon. But that he manages to string it out for another year or two is incredible. But we'll talk about that after we listen to this. He undertook to conquer Russia so as to get them to assist in or to stop bleeding or leaking the continental system, which was supposed to be essentially an isolation of Britain. So how does he mount that campaign?
Well, that is the astonishing thing. I mean, Napoleon assembles an army of well over 650,000 men. We don't know exactly.
They're not all French, right?
They're not all French, and in fact, French is not the dominant language. There's an enormous this is the Napoleonic Empire at work. All of those satellite countries are compelled to provide contingents for him. There's a large Polish contingent, there's a large Westphalian contingent, and on and on and on. There's a Prussian contingent. But I suppose this is most indicative of, if not the genius of Napoleon, at least part of it, is that no one else in Europe, and probably no one until the 20th century, could have assembled an army that size and moved an army that size, you know, across into Russia. The logistic capacity of the French Empire. The same thing in Spain. He moves an army from Germany to Spain in a matter of 3 weeks. It's phenomenal. Nobody could possibly
When
do
did
that.
He start the invasion, and from where?
He starts the invasion from, from Germany and through Poland, and then he crosses the Niemen River, and he starts marching into Russia with this fabulous force.
Is it a springtime operation?
Yes. Well, he's a little delayed. It's approximately the same time that Hitler begins Barbarossa.
That's, of course, why I'm asking.
Yeah, it's a June
Hitler
invasion.
Begins his invasion in June.
Right, so is this.
Yeah.
Many, many interesting things about this. I suppose the most interesting is the persistence of a myth, and the myth is begun by Napoleon himself. He says when he leaves the rest of that army in Russia and flees back to Paris, wants to get back before the bad news arrives, that he fought well, but you cannot fight General Winter. And in fact, what is clear is that the majority, the bulk of that army is lost getting to Moscow. He gets to Moscow with maybe 120, 130,000 men, and he's lost all those others to the heat, to the lack of water, to the lack of forage for his horses, to Cossack raids, and coming back, of course, whatever's left of that army is taken care of by the winter.
What's the name of the Russian general who handles the retreat so effectively?
You're talking about Kutuzov?
Kutuzov.
In terms of pursuing, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Kutuzov's strategy was what?
Well, he's going to fall back, and he does fall back, and until he can't fall back anymore, he has to make a stand to Borodino in front of Moscow and at least show that he's going to try to stop the Russian invasion. I mean, the Russian people don't like the fact that their territory is being overrun. And that battle, I think, shows brilliance of Kutuzov's delaying tactics. If he had tried to make that stand earlier, I think it would have been really problematic for him. But it also, I think, shows a real problem with Napoleon's overall system. Napoleon's system is predicated on defeating the enemy army completely and then forcing a quick peace. When he cannot do that, as he can't at Borodino, he fails. And he fails here dramatically.
And in our overview of, in our quick review of the public career of Napoleon Bonaparte, we are continuing in conversation with Brian Sandberg and David Jordan. Brian Sandberg, professor of history at Northern Illinois University. David Jordan, professor of history at the University of Illinois Chicago. Both of them much involved in the study of French history, of course. And indeed, David Jordan has a major book on Napoleon, which is in the works at the moment. You're writing it.
Yes.
What will you be saying in it about the defeat in the Russian campaign?
Well, that is the beginning of the end. There's no recovering from that. And particularly the things that he cannot recover from, the men he can replace, but the thing he's unable to replace from then on in all of his battles are the horses. And Napoleon never has, again, a cavalry to use adequately in battle, and so he's sort of fighting with one hand tied behind
his back. I thought you'd
say
he can't replace his reputation. After all, he sacrificed perhaps 500,000 men, didn't he?
Yes, that's right, but they were not mostly Frenchmen. And that's not what does him in. I mean, he still has the old magic. He still has the old magic when he comes back in 1814. The army goes over to him, and
he's still charismatic.
Yeah. Exactly so. But there are things you simply cannot overcome. And it's only really in retrospect that it is as catastrophic. We now know it to be as catastrophic as it was.
So it's a horse, my kingdom for...
Tens of thousands of horses. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, a horse really in this period still is sort of like a tank today. I mean, it's a highly developed animal, highly trained, and you can't have good cavalry if you don't have well-trained horses. Well-trained, well-cared-for horses. Very expensive.
Yeah.
Very, very expensive.
And it's fundamental to the tactics of the day. And
absolutely.
Part of Napoleon's notion of destroying the other army is that something he did, which no one else had done in 18th century warfare, is he set them into retreat, and then the cavalry goes after them and cuts them down.
Another brief musical selection.
Ah, yes.
Heinrich Heine, the great German poet, who was a great Napoleonist, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
He bought the myth of Napoleon. And now he's treating the retreat from Russia. And he's got two grenadiers who are, in English translation, it's returning from Russia, two grenadiers were traveling to Paris together. I think that's... And here is just the beginning of that. Die beiden Grenadiere by Schumann, sung by Ian Bostridge.
Zogen zwei Grenadier, die waren in Russland gefangen, und als sie kamen ins deutsche Quartier, sie ließen die Köpfe hangen. Da hörten sie beide die traurige Welt, dass Frankreich verloren gegangen, besiegt und geschlagen das tapfere Heer und der Kaiser gehangen.
The key line there, der Kaiser, the emperor, is taken. They get the word that the emperor has been captured, which wasn't true.
No.
Yeah.
No, he leaves the army, flees with Caulaincourt, his master of the horse, to Dresden and then to Paris. He wants to get to Paris before the news of the great catastrophe arrives so that he can obviously spin it. And Caulaincourt, it's a very interesting memoir because Caulaincourt travels for a number of weeks in this closed sled with Napoleon, and Napoleon talks incessantly about himself. And you can see him working through so that he comes up with his vision of, his version of what happened in Russia.
A simple question, and I regress, or I repair to being the psychologist that in fact I am. Personality is, after all, fascinating. The personality of great historical actors is always fascinating. Do you think that ever in his career Napoleon had any promptings of guilt at the thought that he had led millions to death?
He doesn't seem to have. I mean, he talks about his men with great admiration. He certainly, when he wants something from his men, challenges them and rewards them. But when he talks amongst his officers or when he remembers back to the wars, he's very callous. He doesn't seem to care about the lives of his men.
Now, we also have, after his exile to Elba, and which is first,
Elba's first.
And St. Helena, right. Mm-hmm. where he spends the rest of his life, everything he says is written down by some camp follower who stays with him loyally. Does he ever, in all of those continuing reflections, make any reference to the millions that he killed?
No. No, he talks about, apparently at the Battle of Eylau in 1807, he was distraught by the first major bloodletting.
Yeah.
And he apparently spends the night on the battlefield amidst all the bodies. But no, and when he's dictating, there are four men to whom he dictates this his life, essentially,
yeah.
his myth-making. And three of them are military men, and one Las Casas is not. And no, there was no sense. He's not like us.
Scott Fitzgerald says to Ernest Hemingway, Ernest, the rich are very different from us. And Hemingway's great put down is, yes, Scott, they have more money. And if one said, the world conquerors are very different from us, the answer is...
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. I think you don't enter into that kind of brutality of politics if you care in any close way about human life.
One can think certainly of a parallel, whether one likes it or not, whether it would be rejected by lots of loyal Francophiles, a parallel to Hitler. Hitler's, in many ways, visibly and externally, a meaner, more dreadful man. But still, Hitler didn't give a thought, really, to the millions he killed. And of course, he went on not only to have soldiers die for him or under his command, but to run extermination programs, which Napoleon did not do. But this is a different species.
Yeah, I suppose that's right, but I wonder if American generals are much more humane. Maybe it is simply the nature of warfare that one cannot be.
Well, Sherman says war is hell, and I think he means it's hell because people die.
Yes. On the other hand, he seems to have enjoyed it.
And he
was very good at it.
Yeah.
Well, and there are different periods where you have a sense of limits on war. We have ideas of laws of war. But Napoleon doesn't feel himself very constrained by any laws of war. Mm. He wants what he wants, and he's going to get it using his men and over the backs of the other countries that he has to march over to get it.
How does he come to his final end? It's about 2 years after the defeat in Russia before he finally surrenders, gives up, and accepts the exile to Elba, isn't it?
Yes, and he's forced really by his generals to abdicate, and originally he wants to abdicate and put his son on the throne, and they say no, and finally the agreement is that he will lay down his arms because they refuse to fight in Paris. They will not defend Paris against the Allies, and so
the Allies are coming on.
Oh yeah, and it's the Tsar, I think, who's Tsar Alexander I, who's most responsible for this. He manages to hold the coalition together in 1813 and after 1813, after the Battle of Leipzig, and he insists they not pause in the march on Paris. The Allies are very anxious to rest, and I think had they rested, Napoleon would have recouped himself and it would have been much more difficult to beat him.
I agree with that, but I think that after the Russian campaign, another important element here is that the satellite kingdoms start to fall away,
right.
And also the countries like Prussia that had been sort of forced into helping out Napoleon very begrudgingly in the Russian campaign, they're now his enemies. So there are more and more enemies against Napoleon. His unwillingness to accept his empire as it was in 1810 then becomes really a big undoing here.
What year does he accept the exile to Elba? Is it 1813?
1814.
1814. And of course, he utters the famous palindrome in English, Able was I ere I saw Elba. It reads the same backwards as forward.
Okay.
That's what a palindrome is, of course. I don't know who invented that. I wonder whether Napoleon knew any English.
He knew some English. He studied English. His English was very, very primitive. There are a couple of examples of him writing in English, and it's extraordinarily clumsy.
But he doesn't accept. What was the deal when he went off to Elba? He was given command of Elba, was he not?
The emperor, the king.
It's the kingdom of Elba.
What was
Elba? And Elba is a beautiful island. There are many American tourists who flock to Elba every summer.
But it had a population of how many at the time?
I'm not really sure, but very few.
A few thousand.
You had some iron mines, I think, there on the coast, and you have a couple of villages.
Yeah, and he reforms the post office, and he builds some beautiful gardens, and then he's bored, you know.
So he decides
to escape. To escape with his men, return to France, and begin a march back to Paris.
That's the famous 100 days.
Yes.
What does he do? How does he do it?
Well, it's an astonishing story, really. I mean, the Allies have put Louis XVIII, who's the oldest of Louis XVI's two younger brothers, back on the throne. They've restored him as Louis XVIII. The Allies are still in France. An enormous indemnity has been fixed upon the French, and Napoleon lands. And Louis XVIII says to Marshal Ney, some of the marshals have gone over to the Restoration government, he says, go and bring Napoleon back in a cage.
It doesn't work out this way.
Well, it doesn't quite work out that way. And it is really one of those wonderful dramatic moments where the Napoleon rides up and there's the French army that's come to bring him back in an iron cage, and he leaps off his horse and pulls back his great red and gold coat, and he says, shoot me, I am your emperor. And the army goes bananas and goes over to him, and then begins this fabulous march.
Ney goes over to him
And Ney goes over to him as well, and begins this fabulous march to Grenoble, and eventually, and Louis XVIII immediately flees the throne, leaving it empty. And Napoleon arrives in Paris, and then begins a very clever attempt to attract everyone to his flag. That is, he becomes a liberal, if you will. He makes an appeal to the Jacobins. He makes an appeal to the Republicans. Disingenuous, no doubt, but
and of course, the other Europeans are not going to put up with this.
Right.
I mean, they're already hammering out the post-Napoleonic War peace.
Mm-hmm. They're
and
in Vienna.
Suddenly they're in Vienna, and they hear of Napoleon's
Vienna,
return.
1814, right?
1814, 1815. Yeah. And so sure are they of victory that they tell a story about Metternich, the Austrian foreign minister, that when he receives the notice that Napoleon's escaped from Elba, he doesn't open the letter till the following day, and they do not interrupt their deliberations. And they're right. Napoleon's finished.
He comes to his Waterloo, in fact.
Right.
At Waterloo.
Right.
Indeed.
What can we say about that battle? Might it have turned otherwise?
I don't think so. I mean, Napoleon could have won that battle. The Allies were very firm, and they had all the cards in their hands. Napoleon could win two or three battles. It was not going to win the war.
He was still doomed.
He was doomed.
Yeah.
And the thing that's interesting about Waterloo is that you know, this is probably the most talked about battle in all of history.
Yeah.
And
why?
People obsess on, you know, Napoleon's possibility of winning it. It wouldn't have mattered.
Right.
What's more interesting about Waterloo is that every European country has made Waterloo, who was involved in the battle at least, has made Waterloo part of their national history.
Mm-hmm.
So the British claim to have won at Waterloo. Of course, Wellington. But the Prussians claim to have won at Waterloo.
Right.
And French people can claim that, you know, there's somebody who lost it for him. So you blame Grouchy.
Of the battle and their victory at Waterloo, Wellington says it was a damned close-run thing, suggesting that...
Well, the interesting thing for me is that it's not a particularly interesting battle. We happen to know every detail about it. It's not one of Napoleon's great battles, nor is it one of Wellington's great battles.
Mm-hmm.
It's two relatively second-class armies facing each other. It's because that's Napoleon's final battle that it comes down to it. And there's a nice thing that happens because there's a nice parallel with Marengo. In Marengo, Desaix is sent off. Napoleon splits his army, sends Desaix off to find the Austrians, and Desaix hears the cannon fire and comes back late afternoon and saves the battle. At Waterloo, Napoleon splits his army again. Every time he splits his army, he loses the battle. Splits his army again and sends Grouchy off. Grouchy hears the cannon and keeps going because he's so terrified that he will disobey Napoleon's orders and have to suffer one of those temper tantrums of Napoleon's. And who knows? His return may have saved the battle. But I agree with Brian. It's all over.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good example. He doesn't have his veteran officers. He no longer has the old Grand Armée at this point. And he's also facing a coalition that is much more powerful and much more determined than
some
any of
his former marshals. He had the great group of the marshals of France.
Some.
Some are fighting against him, are they not?
Well, Bernadotte is certainly not with him. Ney is with him. What's his name? Is not Berthier, the great general staff officer, is not there. A whole bunch.
A number are dead at this point. Others are performing dead, organizational and staff functions back in Paris or other parts of France.
Some commercials are overdue at the moment. Then we want to come, before we go to the phones, and though I will invite calls right now, the lines are instantly and magically open, 591-7200. 591-7200 is the number. You can get your calls in. We'll be with you shortly. But we need to treat the last years of Napoleon in true exile on the island of St. Helena and the death of Napoleon, about which there still hovers some ambiguity or mystery, or at least some conspiratorial retellings. We return to David Jordan and Brian Sandberg and to Napoleon Bonaparte after this. So, the last years, by 1815, he's sent off to St. Helena, which is a drearier place than Elba.
Oh, certainly, certainly.
Where is St. Helena?
It's off the African coast.
It's 1,200 miles off the African coast. It's 1,400 miles off the Brazilian coast.
It's sort of nowhere. Yeah, and there wasn't much there except a lot of rocks.
Well, it's tropical, and there are a lot of rocks, yeah.
And there's a British garrison which keeps him under permanent guard for the remaining 6 years of his life. He's sent there in 1815. He dies in 1821 at the advanced age of 52.
Yes, absolutely. It's sort of crazy. There is a governor, Hudson, who's a very punctilious man who insists upon Napoleon always being in sight and sort of poisons his life. And where did he think he was going to go? And the closest place was Assumption Island, which is 700 miles away. But as I say, he's a very small-minded guy, and so Napoleon's life is poisoned by this man. But he does have four, they're called the four evangels, and they are General Berthier and Gourgaud and Montholon, all of whom are generals and to whom Napoleon dictates various of his battles. And there is Lascars, who had been an émigré, that is, a nobleman who had fled abroad and came back. Napoleon's fascinated by that. And each of them talks to Napoleon in a different way, and he speaks to them in a different way. It is the publication of Lascars' Memorial that creates, almost instantaneously, in the late 1820s, 1828, I think it is, the Napoleonic myth, the publication of that book. And there Napoleon appears as a grand figure, a figure who martyred himself to France. It's a very formal, and Lascars is a great writer, and so it is, in fact, a great book. And Napoleon said that without St. Helena, he wouldn't have had that final tragic dimension to his life.
But David, you are launched into a major book on Napoleon. I look forward to reading it. It may be 2 or 3 years from now before I get my hands on a published copy. But I know your other work, and I much admired and enjoyed your earlier work, way back to your volume on Gibbon, which is just the best thing I've ever read about the great historian of the fall of the Roman Empire. But what is your overall view? What's the thesis that you lay out or will lay out in that book?
Well, what I want to argue is that Napoleon inadvertently saves the French Revolution. And he saves it in a very odd way, by pursuing his own glory, by pursuing this egomania to establish this empire in the middle of civilized Europe. He manages to keep the rest of Europe, that is to say monarchical Europe, still unreformed and unrevolutionized Europe, out of France. And so the French Revolution does not suffer what happens in China, what happens in Russia, what happens in Cuba. It's not isolated, it's not cut into pieces, it's not quarantined, and in all of those revolutions, when that happens in the 20th century, they all turn inward. Terror becomes a major means of governance. The terror never comes back to France. And by the time Napoleon is gotten rid of, the Allies assembled at Vienna find themselves perfectly willing to accept the revolutionary settlement. Everything about the revolutionary settlement in France is left untouched. Most particularly, the most important part of it, the property settlement, and all of Napoleon's legislation and all of Napoleon's reforms. Every place else in Europe, it's undone. But the accomplishments of the revolution are left intact, and so too, it seems to me, is the revolutionary tradition. It hasn't really been perverted.
Which reappears again, does it not, in the year 1848?
1830, 1848, 1871. All around Europe. There it is, embedded in French history in the 19th century. Yeah. And I think, as I say, he has no intention of doing that. He is a man who wants law and order above all things. He has no sympathy with lots of the goals of the revolution. And yet, in this very curious way, which I think Hegel understands perfectly well, Napoleon ends up.
So your argument is that the continuing democratization of Europe, which occurs on and off through the rest of the 19th century, is in consequence of Napoleon's career.
In a way, I mean, all the European countries do trace their kind of modern history, if you will, from the Napoleonic period, that their national awareness.
As, for example, Italy's coming together under Cavour and so on, has a Napoleonic model, does it?
Yes, it probably would have been impossible had Napoleon not driven the Austrians out the first time and rationalized the peninsula.
Brian, how does that thesis grab you?
I think it's interesting. I think that for too long people have focused on just the figure of Napoleon, who's so fascinating as a personality, and that is important. But his lasting legacy and what we make of that is just as important. And we can see that in one way in David's work here, but we can also see that in terms of his lasting impact on Europe, on the system there, and also on, I think, military history, on warfare. And there, maybe the impact is more negative, because he was callous, as we said, and promoted a sort of brutality, an ultimate brutality of war, but also because he is taken to be this military genius still today, even here in the United States. Very different sort of system. We think of ourselves as living in a democracy. His is an imperial system. And yet many people here in the United States go ahead and promote the same sorts of strategies and views of war that Napoleon promoted.
With that, a quick pause for an update on the news, and then we will go directly to the phones and to the email. Any questions you've got, any thoughts you want to share, move quickly if you want to get in, 591-7200. Some lines are available at the moment, and of course there's infinite capacity on the email roster for email extension 720 at tribune.com. We look forward to your contributions. Get them in now. We'll be with you in just a few minutes. And we will go directly to the phones for your questions to David Jordan and Brian Sandberg. Anything pertaining to the history of Napoleon, the Napoleonic era, Napoleonic warfare, and things thereunto related. 591-7200 is the number. Some lines are available. If you've been trying to reach us and hitting the busy signal, do quickly try again, because we've now cleared a few. And here is the first. Hello, you're on the air.
Thank you, Bill. This is a good show you got tonight. I consider myself a Napoleon fan, and I would disagree with your experts on two different opinions about Waterloo. His two best generals that he could have used, Davout was in Paris as the governor, and Soult he made chief of staff, which he should have never done, and Soult had experience against Wellington in the Peninsula War. And you were talking about Waterloo being insignificant. If you look at that battle being one of the 15 most decisive battles in history, if he pushes Blücher aside and beats Wellington, now he's got negotiating power with the Austrians and Russians. Napoleon does.
Mm-hmm. So you think it could have been decisive and that his decline was not inevitable?
I don't think it was. And you were talking about cavalry at Waterloo. He actually outnumbered Wellington and horses. The problem was he didn't have Murat controlling the cavalry. He had Michael Ney controlling the cavalry.
Well, we're dealing here, gentlemen, with a real buff who knows the terrain and knows the detail of the battle, knows the order of battle closely. How do you respond?
I didn't mean to suggest that it was insignificant. It's obviously a very important battle. I only wanted to suggest that I think, well, I don't know. The very fact that Waterloo's been argued about and talked about and written about for the last 200 years means that it's all controversial. Nobody really knows. And I suppose it is exactly the case because it could have been won by Napoleon. And I believe it could have been won by Napoleon. I think that that would not have made that much difference. I think he was doomed ultimately.
I had one other thought. Besides, Michael Ney should have never commanded the field at Waterloo. What do you think of the dilemma with General Foy marching back and forth between Napoleon's line and Ney's line in the battle?
Well, there are many moments in the battle indeed in the entire campaign, where we have a lot of what-ifs. And Napoleon's troops are not used well. And there are a number of reasons for that. Part of it is his indecision at various points, and part of it is Grouchy's, and part of it is the fact that he doesn't have the best commanders anymore in roles where they can play a pivotal role on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that Waterloo is a great example of our obsession today with the decisive battle. We like to think that, you know, a battle can actually win a war. And many times that's not the case, especially when you need to occupy terrain, especially when you need to control a population, and especially when you're facing governments that are intransigent. And Napoleon has that situation there.
Sir, we thank you for the call. We pause, quick round of commercials, right back to additional calls and to email. Our guest tonight in this overview of the career of Napoleon, a career of great significance and consequence for the unfolding of the history that did in fact occur, so that inevitably one asks, what if he hadn't been there? How different would the rest of history have been from, say, 1800 on to the present moment? Those guests are David Jordan and Brian Sandberg, both of them specialists in French history. David Jordan at UIC here in town, Brian Sandberg at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. We go directly back to the phones, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. Bonsoir, messieurs.
Bonsoir.
Merci. From the period between 1795 to 1918, there was no Poland. And I'm wondering if you're commentate on the fact that
We're losing the signal. We have lost the signal. But I guess the question, this is undoubtedly cell phone and cell phone trouble, but I guess the question is, what did Napoleon have to do with the fate and history of Poland in the years that followed?
It's a very complicated story. He creates the Duchy of Warsaw, and the Poles actually got far, far less from Napoleon.
And he conceives a child with the Polish countess.
That is so, Countess Walewska. He never really had, it seems, any intention of giving the Poles a nation state, but he does create this duchy, and it's absolutely right. Of course, till 1918, there is no Poland, and one of the first things that happens at the Treaty of Vienna is that Russia gets back that chunk of Poland, and Poland is once again divided, as she had been twice in the 18th century.
And if Napoleon hadn't been around at all, Poland wouldn't have done much better, I
think. Oh, would have probably worse.
Yeah.
Although, you know, once again, Napoleon depends very heavily on the Polish troops, who fight gloriously. Mm-hmm. For him, and they get nothing back in return.
Yeah. Here's the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, after having lived such an eventful life, I'm wondering how he spent his last days on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, there's fascinating material from St. Helena, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as David was saying earlier, Napoleon writes a lot while he's there. He doesn't have much else to do, write and talk. And I think he is thinking of how the future will remember him. He's thinking of his historical legacy very consciously and trying to craft an image of himself that's going to be a positive one.
Do you think he's still entertaining notions of breaking out of this place, just as he did at Elba?
He may have early on, but it becomes apparent he knows at a certain point that he's going to die there. He spends an enormous amount of time alone. He seems to be kind of depressed. He spends a lot of time in his bathtub, for example.
Really?
Hours and hours. He reads voluminously, and at night everybody assembles together, and sometimes they play chess. He's a pretty good chess player, not a great one. And he talks about what he's read. And these are wonderful, wonderful kind of disquisitions on particularly the French classic poets of the 17th century, Corneille, Racine. That's what he likes to talk about, and what he has to say is worth listening to.
In what form do we have this material?
Oh, we have four versions of a number of these stories. We have the versions of the three generals and the versions of Las Casas. They're all there.
They all wrote memoirs.
They write things down. Yeah. It's hard to know, of course, just how accurately these conversations are recorded, but in those episodes that occur in more than one version, they're pretty close.
Didn't he have some sort of relationship with a resident English family?
Before he's moved to Longwood, yes.
Yeah. And he sort of got involved with or took a tutorial view of his relationship to some of the adolescent kids of
this English guy. That's right. He loved them, and there are these wonderful stories of him, you know, crawling around, putting on masks and playing children's games with them and hide and seek and so on, yeah.
Who was his last wife?
Maria Theresa.
It was Maria Theresa, the empress. What happened to her?
Well, when he goes into exile, she's forbidden to follow him, and so too is his son, the king of Rome. She's taken back to Vienna, and so too is the little boy. And she then turns out to be a sort of a featherhead and is set up with an officer, an Austrian officer, and forgets about Napoleon. He's heartbroken about not seeing his son, though.
Was the son known as the Eagle?
L'Aiglet, yes.
L'Aiglet. What happens to him?
He dies at the age of 17 of tuberculosis. He's thought to be have some of his father's features, and the contemporary reports are that he had this incredible incisive mind, much as his father did.
Yet there are other Napoleons who come to leadership in France later on.
Oh, well, Napoleon III.
Who was he? He wasn't a son. He was, what was he, a cousin, a nephew?
He's a nephew. And, he's a consummate politician. Much more a political leader, not a military leader. However, very concerned with image making, I think. And I know David has written about his program in Paris, the actual re-envisioning of the city of Paris, and the Paris we know today is a product of Napoleon III.
He's the guy who hires Baron Haussmann to reorganize
Paris.
And he's also instrumental in his uncle's reputation. He publishes Napoleon's letters in 32 volumes, selected. I mean, it's not such a great editing job. And he finishes a lot of Napoleon's projects, and he's always linking himself to Napoleon.
And he also conquers, or thinks he does, Mexico, does he not?
He tries. It's a, it's a catastrophe, of course.
And he puts some Austrian guy on the throne who is killed in the Mexican Revolution?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Shot by firing squad. Maximilian.
Fascinating history. Our thanks to the caller. A last round of commercials, then we return. And again, if this discussion has whetted your appetite for more information about Napoleon, we invite you to simply go to the blog of this program, which is called miltzfile.com. Just miltzfile.com, entered on your computer screen, and you will get instantly to our blog, which features a lot of stuff that we put up through the week, material from much of it bearing upon contemporary politics, also upon the arts, upon history indeed, and drawn not only from the daily press and the periodical press, but also from scholarly sources, and following, if anything, sort of the whims and special interests of the host of this program, though it does reflect in general what we often talk about on this program. And tonight we've put up as the lead item a link to the Wikipedia extended article on the career of Napoleon, which I looked at earlier and found of considerable interest and I think of significant scholarly reliability, though I don't yet have the judgment of either David Jordan or Brian Sandberg on that. 591-7200 is our number. You are the next caller. Good evening.
Yes, good evening.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering if you could address whether Napoleon's Italian ethnicity, as being from Corsica, was ever used against him during his career. And also, I wonder how this cult of personality that involved Napoleon could lead as the British upper classes having Napoleonic busts in their private libraries. And if I recall being correctly, Parliament even investigated supposed Napoleon's.
We're having trouble on the phones tonight. You're not the same guy who called before, are you?
No.
Well,
yes,
you're fading. Are you on a cell phone, sir?
Yes, I apologize.
I fear it's not working very well, but we get the general question, and we will pursue it. Napoleon as Italian. Is Corsican Italian?
Well, that depends. Corsica is either Italian or French. It depends on who you ask that question. Yeah. And that was true in Napoleon's time, too. This was an open debate, depending on the time period. But, Napoleon's Italian background was certainly used against him in the anti-Napoleon propaganda. Absolutely. And he certainly tried to escape his Italianness in promoting himself as a good French revolutionary.
Was he, do you think, an Italian speaker?
His first language was the Corsican dialect. His second language was Italian. His third was French. He always spoke with an accent. He couldn't write. I mean, he always dictated everything and apparently made grammatical errors, which his amanuenses would correct, and one of his contemporaries said he simply didn't have the patience to.
Isn't that interesting?
To learn.
Hitler's an Austrian, Stalin's a Georgian.
Also, the outsider status
is
very important.
They're outlanders.
But of course, right. We can also see this as very traditional, because in the European court system, where you have exchange of brides between courts throughout the long Middle Ages and early modern periods, this was typical. You always had people who were not native speakers who were trying to exercise power. And I work with Maria de' Medici, Catherine de' Medici. Catherine mastered French better than Maria did and may have had a little bit easier time with her political rule in France because of that. But Napoleon, I think, dealt with the language issues, whatever there were, and dealt with his Italian background. In terms of the other question here about cult of personality, we can look at the flip side. Instead of the anti-Napoleon propaganda, look at the Napoleon propaganda. And he certainly does build up his own personality.
Isn't he, in a way, the inventor of the modern propagandized cult of personality?
I think so. I mean, part of this is coming out of the French Revolution. The French Revolution, I think, according to a lot of historians, has had a really key role in creating modern political culture in general. And so that is part of that revolutionary trend, and Napoleon fine-tunes the propaganda machine of the revolution.
Yes, so I think that's absolutely right. And there's some glimmer of that in Robespierre's career, certainly among his enemies. They believed that he was trying to set himself up, and it was even thought, there was rumor in the year of his death, as his fall, that he wanted to be king. Robespierre was planning to be king and marry a princess. Go back to this old, earlier notion of European politics, attach himself to a royal house.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've done a book on Robespierre, as I mentioned earlier. Do you think that was, in fact, his real motivation?
He certainly used the notion of personifying ideas as a political instrument. In much the said that he was an embodiment, that he was the revolution. He would say things like, "I don't speak for myself. This is the revolution speaking." At another point, he says, "I am the people."
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a peculiar notion of politics, and Napoleon has it too. Within him are the great issues, the great anxieties of the age.
Of course, that's sort of an old stance in France. Was it Louis XIV who said, "The state is me"?
Right, and Joan of Arc is another, and de Gaulle. I mean, it seems to be a tradition in French politics, this notion of embodiment. I don't think you'd ever find an American politician doing that, saying, "I am America."
Frank Haig, the dictatorial mayor of Jersey City, who you probably never heard of.
That's right.
Was famous for having said, "I am the law."
Uh-huh.
Which is a near equivalent. Let's work in another caller quickly, 591-7200. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
One quick clarification before I get to my main question. The son of Napoleon who died at 17 of tuberculosis, was that his son with the Polish noblewoman?
No.
No, with Marie Louise.
I see. So the son in Poland, did he have descendants or did Napoleon's line die out?
Does he have descendants? Well, Napoleon's line doesn't die out because there are a whole bunch of Bonapartes and there's still Bonapartes around today. Oddly enough, mostly from his brother. He comes from a family of eight, and a bunch of them had children.
The woman who funded Sigmund Freud, of all people, was Marie Bonaparte.
Bonaparte, right.
Yeah.
My main question is this. And this, of course, did not involve Napoleon's direct generalship, but French forces in Haiti had enormous difficulty contending with the military genius of Toussaint Louverture, the former slave, and were, in fact, defeated by him, and as a result, Napoleon decided to divest France of its New World possessions. If Napoleon had taken a closer hand in what was going on in the New World and understood the potential for empire and what became the Louisiana Purchase, how would that have affected history?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think we have any real answers for that. We can imagine the possibilities, but I think it's hard to imagine Napoleon ever leaving Europe itself and going to any colonial adventure. It wasn't the center of what he considered to be the action. For him, the action was dominating Europe, dominating the metropole of the colonies, not to the outward peripheries of empire. He wanted to dominate other powerful states, and he needed to be at the center of empire to do that.
Although he has a recurring fantasy, and that was he regrets not having gone east, not having gone from Egypt to Constantinople and then to the Indus, following Alexander the Great's career.
This goes back to the previous listener's question.
behind us, though we will continue, is the end of Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture, which marks, of course, the end of the beginning of the end for Napoleon. But please continue.
No, fantastic music. But I was just going to say that that cult of personality tells us something important about Napoleon. He's not just a French figure. He has become this Mars, this god of war, and he's part of the story of the great conquerors. So that dream of going east is a reference back to Alexander. He also references Julius Caesar because he wants to be that great conqueror. And this explains partly why, you know, British nobles could venerate him. They too want to be part of this tradition of Mars.
As somebody says of Julius Caesar, all in all, he was a man we shall not look upon his like again. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it's just as well that we don't look upon his like again.
Yes, probably all the great conquerors could say that.
But we have looked upon his like again, but worse. Since it, have we not?
Yes, I think that's right.
We will end with warm thanks from the host to David Jordan and Brian Sandberg for joining us tonight. There it is, the end of the conclusion of the 1812 Overture. And that is the Russian national anthem. And I think the Marseillaise works in there.
Earlier.
Right? That was earlier, yeah. And so we'll end with the strains. There's the cannon. I don't know, I'm not sure whether that's supposed to be the cannon in the Battle of Borodino or what. But
indeed.
Rest is silence as we go to Tchaikovsky for the last minute. Thanks again to our guests. Thanks a lot for listening. And a most cordial good night. We'll be right back.